Chapter 10 In the Outhouse. Dagestan is the southernmost part of Russia, an ethnically diverse land that borders the Caspian Sea and rises into the mountain peaks of the Eastern Caucasus at its border with Chechnya. Like Chechnya, it is predominantly Muslim, but it is also one of the most heterogeneous places in the world, with dozens of ethnicities and languages. It first came under Russian rule at the beginning of the 19th century and had joined the other republics of the Caucasus to form a briefly independent state after the Bolshevik Revolution. With the collapse of the Soviet Union, however, it did not join Chechnya in declaring its independence from Russia. Secession had little public support there among the various peoples, though the idea of unifying with Chechnya was debated for much of the 1990s. The commander who led the incursion from Chechnya on August 7th, Shamil Basayev, declared his intention to create an Islamic state of Dagestan, hoping to expand his political and ideological campaign of violence and terror in order to bolster his own power in Chechnya. Along with the Saudi fighter Khattab, he led a force of 2,000 fighters who seized the small villages along the mountainous border. The exact goal of the raid remained unclear, but thanks to the tensions that had been rising ever since General Shpigun's kidnapping, his body would later be found, the Russian military was better prepared. As Interior Minister and, after May, as Prime Minister, Sergei Stepashin had drafted plans for a police and military operation that would restore federal order in Chechnya. Putin, as FSB chief and head of Yeltsin's Security Council, was involved in shaping those plans. Stepashin would later claim that they had settled on the timing of the operation, August or September, long before Basayev's incursion. Stepashin's plan had limited military objectives: to seize the plains in the northern third of Chechnya, the lowlands up to the Terek River, creating a cordon sanitaire that would contain the radicalism and criminality in the Republic's mountains. In the wake of Basayev's incursion into Dagestan, Putin now had something far more ambitious in mind. He asked Yeltsin for absolute power to coordinate all the security ministries and conduct military operations, authority that officially belonged to the president as commander-in-chief. Yeltsin agreed, the first time he had delegated so much of his presidential prerogative to a prime minister. The day after his appointment in August, Putin declared that Russia's commanders would re-establish control in Dagestan, and he gave them a deadline of 2 weeks. His nomination had not even been confirmed yet. By August 13th, Russian bombers and helicopter gunships bombarded the villages occupied by the Chechen fighters, and Putin threatened to carry the air war into Chechnya itself. The next day, the Russians did exactly that, bombing villages that the incursion forces were using as bases. On August 16th, the Duma took up Putin's nomination and by only a narrow margin confirmed him after a debate that focused more on the election campaign than on his qualifications for the post or the violence unfolding in the south. He received 233 votes, only 7 more than the minimum needed, and far less than Stepashin, Primakov, or Kiryenko had. Putin seemed a transitional figure at best, soon to be swept aside. In his brief, clipped remarks before the parliament, Putin pledged to restore discipline in the government, and he reminded Russia's generals of the deadline for repulsing the invaders in Dagestan. They have 1 week left. And a week later, Basayev's fighters withdrew, having miscalculated the ferocity of the Russian reprisals and the dearth of local support in Dagestan for an Islamic uprising. Although Dagestan had adherence to a radical strain of Islam, the Republic's myriad ethnic groups remained far more loyal to the Russian state than the Chechens. Local police and paramilitary forces had joined the federal troops in resisting the invaders, and by August 26th, they had raised Russia's tricolor flag over the villages that had been occupied and then destroyed in 2 weeks of airstrikes. The next day, Putin flew to Dagestan, accompanied by newspaper and television journalists who were not told their destination until they landed at the regional capital, Makhachkala. With heavy security and complete secrecy, the entourage then boarded a helicopter and flew to Botlik, a mountain village at the center of the invasion, only 5 miles from the Chechen border. Putin, dressed casually in slacks and a jacket, addressed a group of Russian and Dagestani fighters and passed out 50 medals. He announced that 3 Hero of Russia medals, the nation's highest military honor, would be awarded later in ceremonies at the Kremlin. A 4th would be granted posthumously. By the official count, nearly 60 Russian soldiers had died during the fighting. No one announced the rebel or civilian casualties, but Putin was there to proclaim their cause just, the losses worthy. He began to offer a toast to those who died, but stopped in mid-sentence. "Wait a second, please," he said. "I would like to drink to the health of those injured and to wish happiness to everyone present, but we have a lot of problems and big tasks ahead of us. You know it very well. You know the plans of the enemy. We know them too. We know about the acts of provocation to be expected in the near future. We know in which areas we should expect them and so on. We have no right to allow ourselves even a second of weakness, not a single second. For if we let our guard down, then those who died will seem to have died in vain. Therefore, I suggest that today we put the glass back on the table. We will definitely drink to them, but later." Putin's flash visit was political theater from a political novice, but the contrast with Yeltsin was profound. Youth and vigor versus age and infirmity. A dejected, divided nation could now relish a military victory, presided over by a prime minister most considered a little colorless, if they knew much about him at all. And yet, Putin's remarks also contained the seeds of caution, and some believed forewarning, that the conflict had not ended with Basayev's retreat back into Chechnya. Less than a week later, on the night of September 4th, an enormous explosion leveled a 5-story building in Buynask, about 40 miles south of Dagestan's capital. The building housed Russian soldiers and their families, many of whom had settled in front of their televisions to watch a soccer match between Ukraine and France. The explosion, possibly a car bomb, killed 64 people. The next day, Chechen militants again crossed into Dagestan, this time near Kusavyurt, the city where the peace accords ending the first war had been signed 3 years earlier. Yeltsin exploded in anger at a September 6th meeting of the Security Council. "How did we lose a whole district in Dagestan?" the president thundered. "This can only be explained by the carelessness of the military." Yeltsin had extended sweeping authority to his new prime minister, and after an initial success, disaster struck anyway. The predictions of Putin's quick demise seemed prophetic. Then, on September 9th, the carnage of the Caucasus came to Moscow. Just after midnight, an explosion ripped through the center of a 9-story apartment complex at 19 Gurianova Street, not far from a wide bend in the Moscow River. The force of the blast, equivalent to hundreds of pounds of TNT, cleaved the wide rectangular building in two, as if it had been split by a giant axe. Those asleep inside were crushed in a burning pile of debris. At first, investigators thought a gas leak might have been the cause, but by the next day, officials began to suspect an act of terrorism, the worst ever in the Russian capital. An anonymous caller telephoned the Interfax news agency and said the explosions in Moscow and Buynak were deliberate acts of retaliation for the Russian strikes in Chechnya and Dagestan. The same, or another caller, with an accent of the Northern Caucasus, had warned Deutsche Welle's office in Moscow days before the explosion that there would be 3 bombings in the city to punish Russia. "If it is confirmed that this is a terrorist act, and everything is leading that way, we shall have to acknowledge that the echo of war in Dagestan is sounding in Moscow," Mayor Lushkov declared, pledging to tighten security. 94 people died as a result of the bombing, and hundreds more were injured. On September 11th, Even as emergency workers continued clearing the rubble from Gurianova Street, Putin flew to New Zealand to attend the annual Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Forum in place of the ailing Yeltsin. The forum gathers the leaders of 21 nations, and Putin's attendance amounted to his debut on the international stage. The leaders were curious to meet Yeltsin's fifth prime minister in the last 18 months, though few expected he would last any longer than the others. The violence around Chechnya that summer had already raised alarms in the West, and President Clinton used his meeting with Putin to gently raise concerns about the humanitarian tragedy in the region and to urge a political resolution that could include allowing international observers on Russian soil. Putin began politely, expressing confidence that the strains over Kosovo earlier in the year were behind them, and hoping for a mutual understanding of the shared threat of international terrorism. When Clinton pressed on Chechnya, though, Putin's mouth tightened, his posture stiffened, and a hard-eyed look came over his face. He drew a map on a napkin, explaining to Clinton the plans that had already been drawn up for the limited incursion, halting at the Terek River. He stressed that the fighting in Dagestan was not merely an isolated raid, but the beginning of an invasion of Russia, supported by international terrorists, including Osama bin Laden. He told Clinton that bin Laden, whose Al-Qaeda network had orchestrated attacks on the American embassies in Kenya and Tanzania the year before, had financed Chechnya's Islamic fighters and even visited Chechnya, though the Americans were never able to confirm that. Putin confided to the American president what he had not yet told his own countrymen. Russia's military was about to intervene again in Chechnya. Putin was still in New Zealand on September 13th when an explosion destroyed another apartment building, this time on Kashirskoye Highway in southern Moscow, not far from Gurianova Street. The death toll reached 118, and the country's fear turned to hysteria. Reports of possible motives were confused and contradictory. Putin himself had hesitated after the first attack, stopping short of calling the bombing a terrorist attack. Now he reacted angrily, saying it was impossible to imagine that both bombings could be accidents. "Those who have done it cannot be called humans," he said. "They cannot even be called beasts." He cut short his first international visit as prime minister and returned to Moscow. Who exactly the beasts were, however, was far from clear. Dagestani extremists had reportedly claimed responsibility for the bombing in Buinax, but Chechen leaders, including Shamil Basayev, whose fighters were still in Dagestan, denied involvement in the Moscow bombings, even as Basayev reiterated his vow to carve an Islamic state out of Russia's southern rump. A hard-line communist leader, Viktor Ilyukin, told Itarchas that the first attack was linked not to the Caucasus, but rather to the political feuds between supporters of Yeltsin and Mayor Lushkov. The bombings, he said, were a pretense to cancel the parliamentary elections scheduled for December. "Political hysteria is being fanned artificially," he said. Alexander Lebed, now governor in Krasnoyarsk, told the French newspaper Le Figaro that the Chechens had little to gain from such attacks, but that Yeltsin and his family did. A goal had to be set to create mass terror, a destabilization which will permit them at the needed moment to say, "You don't have to go to the election precincts, otherwise you will risk being blown up with the ballot boxes," Lebed said. The panic in Moscow led to police checkpoints and sweeps that arrested hundreds of people for little other reason than appearing to be from the Caucasus. Citizens mounted their own patrols. The police discovered 76 sacks of explosives in a shed at a building site in the Kapotnia district. The sacks, marked as sugar from a factory in Karachayeva, Cherkessia, in the Caucasus, contained enough material to destroy several more apartment buildings. The discovery ended the bombings in Moscow, but on September 16th, the fourth bombing of an apartment building occurred, this time in the southern city of Volgodonsk, hundreds of miles from either Moscow or Chechnya. The attack differed from the others only in the details. The blast happened at dawn when most people were home asleep. The explosives were loaded in a truck parked outside the building rather than hidden inside, which might have minimized the damage. The force sheared off the facade of the building but did not collapse it. This time, 17 people died. The death toll from the wave of terror had now reached nearly 300. Russia's limited airstrikes inside Chechnya continued, but Putin now escalated the conflict. On September 23rd, Russian aircraft for the first time bombed deep inside the republic, striking Grozny's airport and an oil refinery, which burned out of control because the local authorities had little equipment left to fight fires. The strikes were more punitive than strategic. The attack on the airport destroyed one of Chechnya's two functional aircraft, an old biplane of no military significance. Putin, making an official visit to Kazakhstan, pledged that Russia would defend itself from gangs of foreign mercenaries and terrorists, but he insisted he did not plan a new war in Chechnya. When he was questioned about the purpose of the airstrikes, his temper flared. The laconic manner that Russians had seen in their dour, ascetic new prime minister vanished. He sounded like a street fighter. His answer was blunt, his language salted with the slang of the underworld. "I am tired of answering these questions," he responded testily. "Russian aircraft are only striking terrorist camps. We will go after them wherever they are. If, pardon me, we find them in the toilet, we will waste them in the outhouse." It was a bombing that did not happen that called everything about the events that summer into question. On the evening of September 22nd, the night before Putin's soon-to-be-famous remark about the outhouse, a bus driver who lived in Ryazan, southeast of Moscow, noticed a white Lada parked outside his apartment building. A young woman, clearly of Russian ethnicity, stood nervously at the entrance of the building on Novosyalovaya Street. A man sat inside the car. Soon, another man emerged from the building and the three drove away together. On edge because of the previous bombings, the bus driver called the police. Initially, the police seemed uninterested, but when officers finally arrived, panic erupted. In the basement, a police corporal, Andrei Chernyshev, found three sacks marked sugar, just like the cash found in Moscow, and a device that appeared to be a detonator. A timer had been set for 5:30 in the morning. The police frantically evacuated the 12-story building, while a local explosives expert, Yuri Tkachenka, was summoned to defuse the timer. He tested the substance in the sacks with a gas analyzer. It was not sugar, but a military explosive, hexogen, like one known to have been used in at least one of the Moscow bombings. By the next morning, news reports announced that another catastrophic bombing had, miraculously, been averted. The mood in Ryazan was not celebratory, but the residents and local police received praise. "I want to thank the population for their vigilance," Putin said in televised remarks. As the city's rattled residents contemplated what might have been, police investigators appeared to close in on the would-be bombers. They found the Lada abandoned in a parking lot and briefly stopped two men resembling those spotted outside the apartment building, but they showed FSB identification cards and were released. That evening, a local telephone operator overheard a caller saying there was no way to get out of the city undetected. The voice on the other end of the line told them to split up and make their way out as best they could. The operator informed the police, and the police traced the call to Moscow. To their astonishment, the number belonged to the FSB. By that evening, the FSB's spokesman began casting doubt on everything that had apparently happened in Ryazan, claiming that a preliminary test showed no explosive traces among the materials, which the FSB had by now confiscated and brought to Moscow. There had also been no detonator, he said, just parts of one. The next day, the FSB director, Nikolai Petrushev, spoke to reporters after attending an emergency government meeting to discuss the bombings. Petrushev, Putin's KGB colleague from Petersburg, had followed his friend to Moscow and rose through the ranks with him. He took over as director of the FSB when Putin became prime minister in 1999 and remained one of his most trusted lieutenants. He declared that the entire episode in Rising had simply been a training exercise meant to test preparations for a bombing exactly like those hitting Russian cities. He said the exercises had been conducted in several cities, where they obviously did not work since nothing like Rising happened elsewhere, and complimented the city's residents and police for the vigilance they showed when they discovered these supposed explosives. And at the same time, he added, I want to apologize to them. Patrushev's statement was reported straightforwardly by newspapers in Moscow and beyond, but it stunned and confused people in Rising. Perhaps the residents and the police would not be informed of a test of their vigilance, but even the local FSB department said it had no knowledge of any training. Neither did the mayor or the governor or anyone else. The day and a half delay in informing the city's terrified residents seemed inexplicable, especially since the Interior Ministry had mobilized 1,200 officers in a dragnet to catch the suspects and search for more bombs. And the officers involved in defusing the bomb knew what they had seen. The FSB's drill was either so convincing a test of preparedness in the face of terror or a hoax itself. That evening, a caller telephoned Echo Moskvy, then as now a radio station that encouraged reasonably open political discussion. Identifying himself as a security officer, though not giving his name, he expressed puzzlement over the FSB's explanation. It seemed so improbable, he said, that people might start to think the FSB was somehow involved in all of the bombings. On September 29th, Putin expressed a willingness to negotiate with Aslan Maskhadov, Chechnya's president, but only on the condition that he condemn all terrorism, expel the armed militias in the republic, and arrest and extradite the most wanted criminals, with Basayev, Khatab, and other commanders presumably at the top of the list. It was an ultimatum, not an offer. Maskhadov had denounced the incursion into Dagestan and the bombings in Russia, but his authority as president was too weak to exert control over Basayev or Khatab, let alone arrest them and turn them over to the Russians. I cannot simply have Basayev arrested, he told a journalist 2 days before Putin's ultimatum. People here would not understand that. After all, we fought together for our country's independence. On the day of Putin's offer, Maskhadov had planned to travel to Dagestan to meet with its president to explore the possibility of talks with Moscow, but he had to cancel because protesters in Dagestan blocked the road. It was too late anyway. The next day, the Russian army and Ministry of the Interior soldiers poured into Chechnya. Despite Putin's disavowals, a full invasion had begun. About 40,000 troops had taken part in the first war in Chechnya, many of them unseasoned conscripts, but now Putin ordered in more than 93,000, roughly the size of the Soviet force that invaded Afghanistan, a country nearly 40 times as large. On October 1st, he declared that Russia would no longer recognize Maskhadov's government. Instead, he recognized a regional parliament that had been elected in 1996 during Russia's military occupation. Its members were now mostly in Moscow or elsewhere, having fled when the Russians withdrew after the First War. The declaration ended whatever slim chances existed for a negotiated settlement. Putin did not really want one anyway. Maskhadov joined Basayev and the other more radical commanders in a bloody defense of the Chechen homeland. By October 5th, Russian troops occupied the northern third of Chechnya up to the Terek River, as the secret planning that began in the spring had intended. A week later, they crossed the river and moved toward Grozny. Putin vowed not to repeat the mistakes of the First War, which many took to mean he would not launch an all-out ground offensive to seize control of the entire republic. But that is exactly what he aimed to do. Only this time, he deployed the full force of Russian air power to minimize the loss of life to the Russian troops, irrespective of the toll inside Chechnya. The difference is that this time we will not thoughtlessly send our boys to absorb hostile fire, he told the newspaper Vrimya. We will act with the help of modern forces and means and destroy the terrorists from a distance. We will destroy the infrastructure, and special troops will be used only to clean up territories. There will be no frontal assaults anymore. We will be protecting our men. Of course, this will require time and patience. Availing myself of this opportunity, I urge your readers and others to understand this and to realize that either, as in the past, we rush into the attack with screams of "Communists, forward!" heedless of our losses, or we patiently and methodically destroy them from the air. And if the airstrikes failed? We will succeed, he told the interviewer. There will be no if. On October 20th, as the fighting raged, Putin traveled in secret from Moscow to Chechnya on a journey that included a short flight on a Sukhoi 25 jet. As he had in Dagestan, Putin again handed out medals to pilots at an airbase, and he met with village elders in Znamenskoye, a village just inside Chechnya's border, now liberated by the Russians. He lamented the Chechen government's failure to pay salaries and pensions, and its failure to keep clinics and schools open, despite budget funds from Moscow that had never stopped flowing. Russia's goal was to restore order, he said, by ridding the territory of those bandits who are not only up to their elbows, but up to their shoulders in blood. One of the aims of my visit here today is to show you that we and you are a single whole, so that anti-Chechen and anti-Caucasian feeling is not whipped up in Russia, so that the whole country knows and can see that there is nothing so bloodthirsty here. The next day, a Russian rocket landed in Grozny's central market, killing scores of people, mostly women and children, shopping for dwindling supplies of food. Despite the furor over the apartment bombings and an eruption of anti-Chechen sentiment in Moscow and elsewhere in Russia, the war until then did not have universal political support, especially among the politicians jockeying for power in the coming post-Yeltsin era. The memory of the first war remained raw. By the middle of September, more than 200 Russian soldiers had died in the fighting along Chechnya's borders. The toll inside Chechnya was far higher, probably in the thousands. Yevgeny Primakov, who, with Lushkov, was a frontrunner to replace Yeltsin, expressed support for pinpoint strikes against terrorist camps, but not a new invasion. I am strongly against large-scale operations that can develop into events we have seen in the past, he said. We shouldn't be going back to that. Lushkov responded to the attacks with thinly veiled racism and the reinstitution of Soviet-era residency requirements. His proposal to resolve the conflict was to build a Berlin Wall along Chechnya's border, not to reconquer the territory. Several of Yeltsin's liberal supporters publicly raised doubts about the efficacy and morality of a military campaign that was killing civilians who were, for now at least, citizens of Russia. By the end of September, more than 100,000 Chechens, mostly the elderly, women, and children, had fled for safety into neighboring Ingushetia, creating a refugee crisis that Russia was ill-prepared to handle. The country was again awash in rumors that Yeltsin would resign, that he would dismiss Putin and his new cabinet, that the parliamentary elections scheduled for December would be canceled. Putin was forced to deny them all. Among Russia's political elite, Putin was widely assumed to be committing political suicide by launching a new ground war in Chechnya. Putin behaved like a political kamikaze, throwing his entire stock of political capital into the war, burning it to the ground, wrote Boris Yeltsin, the man who could never bring himself to throw the full might of the Russian military into the first war. Putin acted as if he were indifferent to the politics of the war, perhaps because he had no experience with the first war in Chechnya, perhaps because he simply did not doubt his historic mission. He was not responding to popular opinion or political expedience. As Yeltsin noted, he didn't expect his career to last beyond the Chechen events. His actions seemed defiantly apolitical, even deeply personal, as if the incursion into Dagestan was an affront that he had to avenge. Yet, to the surprise of Yeltsin and many others, Putin's conduct of the war proved to be immensely popular. The first war had been unpopular, but given the public's reaction to the second, that was because the prosecution of the first war had been half-hearted, because the Russian army, the remnant of the Great Red Army, had been ill-prepared and ill-equipped, because the Russians had lost to a bunch of lawless Chechens from the mountains. This war, under this prime minister, seemed different. The political elite, looking ahead to the coming elections, feared the consequences of a war, but now it seemed that ordinary Russians wanted, as Putin, to bang the hell out of the bandits. Vladimir Putin had been largely unknown to Russians when Yeltsin appointed him prime minister. Now, even though he had not yet had time to articulate any policies or programs, his actions in Chechnya began unexpectedly to lift his approval ratings in the polls. In August, when he was appointed, a mere 2% of those polled favored him as a possible presidential candidate. By October, 27% did, only 1 point behind Primakov. Yeltsin kept his promise to Putin about the coming parliamentary elections. He did not have to concern himself with them. Yeltsin's political strategists created a new party called Unity. Like Putin himself, the party had no discernible platform or ideology, but fashioned itself as a patriotic front, adopting the bear as its symbol, an idea that Boris Berezovsky claimed had come to him in a feverish dream while he was hospitalized with hepatitis. Unity seemed to have little chance to win. By the end of October, it barely registered in the polls, far behind the liberals of Yabloko, the communists, and the frontrunners, the Fatherland All-Russia alliance between Lushkov and Primakov. What Unity did have was the full resources of the Kremlin and the oligarchs who poured cash into the campaign. Even Berezovsky, who felt increasingly estranged from Yeltsin, used his television network to savage Lushkov and Primakov, whom he loathed, and to glorify Putin's role as de facto commander-in-chief. Berezovsky gave a primetime television show to a flamboyant commentator, Sergei Dorenko, who week after week accused Lushkov of corruption, hypocrisy, and even murder. The accusations were extreme to the point of libel, but they were extraordinarily effective. Given Yeltsin's paranoia about political challenges, Putin's rising popularity provoked a new wave of rumors about his imminent sacking. Those rumors gained momentum in November when Putin affirmed his intention to run for president in 2000. People assumed that Yeltsin would fire him, as he had fired Primakov, not knowing that the aging president had invested his hopes for his legacy and personal security in this young prime minister. By the end of 1999, Yeltsin's physical and legal problems had left him weaker than ever. Yuri Skuratov, still fighting his suspension as prosecutor general in court, continued to dribble out accusations surrounding the investigations of Mabutex and its ties to Yeltsin's family. His efforts were aided by a decision in Switzerland to freeze 59 bank accounts linked to Russian officials. In October, the Federation Council refused for a third time to fire Skuratov, who was angling to retain his post as prosecutor general under a new parliament and the next president. "Of course the family is afraid," he said in an interview at his dacha outside Moscow. "Now they control the situation, but it may get out of hand." Putin's rising popularity also began to attract the attention of Yeltsin's opponents. On November 20th, Primakov and Lushkov, Yeltsin's bitter rivals, met him privately in hopes of negotiating a political accommodation. Both began to suggest publicly that their alliance might support his nomination for president, effectively abandoning their own ambitions. Putin's rise was as astonishing as it was unexpected. He seemed to represent a new, independent political force. and it was not solely because of Chechnya. In the muck of Russia's politics, he alone seemed untainted by the intrigues of politicians and oligarchs that had consumed Russia for the previous 8 years. Although he owed his career to Yeltsin and the family, the fact that he had mostly worked on the margins of public scrutiny since 1996 meant he was not associated with the Kremlin's multiple failings and scandals. His blunt public statements, even the coarse ones, seemed refreshing after the confusion and obfuscation of Yeltsin's administration. The newspaper, Nezavisimaya Gazeta, wrote in November that within a precious few weeks, a completely unknown, fairly colorless functionary had become a leader willing, unlike his predecessors, to tell people what he intended to do. It went on to call this one of the rare cases in our political history. By then, Putin's approval rating exceeded 40%, and now he had the political clout to influence the parliamentary election in December. He had not joined the Kremlin's new party, Unity, which despite the government's resources, favorable coverage on state television, and donations from the oligarchs, ranked so low in the polls that it risked not reaching the threshold to win any seats in the Duma at all. On November 24th, his 100th day as prime minister, Putin rescued Unity from political oblivion with an endorsement, of a sort. "As the prime minister, I would not want to discuss my political sympathies," he said. "But as an ordinary voter, I will vote for Unity." Most political analysts concluded that Putin was risking not only his own political future, but the party's as well, by linking it too closely with the Kremlin. What they misunderstood was the party's essential appeal as a new force that eschewed the tired ideology of right or left and embraced the patriotism of unity, not division, especially at a time of war. Yeltsin, hospitalized twice in the fall, still agonized over his fate. Authority in Russia had always been transferred through natural death, conspiracy, or revolution, he wrote of his thoughts during the period. The Tsar ceased to rule only after his death or after a coup. It was exactly the same with the General Secretary of the Communist Party. I suppose the communist regime inherited the inability to transfer power painlessly. He reflected on Khrushchev's ouster in 1964 and lamented that his death in September 1971 had been announced in a tiny, obscure notice in the newspaper. On December 14th, 5 days before the election, Yeltsin summoned Putin to his residence at Gorky 9 for a secret meeting. They met alone. "I want to step down this year, Vladimir Vladimirovich," Yeltsin said he told him. "This year, that's very important. The new century must begin with a new political era, the era of Putin. Do you understand?" Putin did not understand. His reaction made Yeltsin's heart sink. There had been rumors throughout the autumn that Yeltsin might step down and, according to the Constitution, pass power to the sitting prime minister. As recently as September, Putin had ruled out the idea as preposterous. "If I am absolutely sure about anything, it is that the president has no intention of going," he said. "No resignation whatsoever." And yet now, Yeltsin explained to him that that was what he intended to do, playing the last trick up his sleeve. The new, untested constitution gave Yeltsin considerable control over the timing of his departure. Were the president to resign, the prime minister would become acting president until elections could be held 90 days later. Although that left little time for an election campaign, it would give the incumbent enormous advantage over his rivals. The two men sat in silence as the realization dawned slowly on Yeltsin that Putin felt unprepared for the presidency. "I'm not ready for that decision, Boris Nikolaevich," Putin finally replied. "It's a rather difficult destiny." Yeltsin, trying to persuade him, explained that he had arrived in Moscow to work when he was already over 50, older than Putin, but an energetic, healthy person nonetheless. Now, he realized, his political life was exhausted. At one time, I, too, wanted to live my life in a completely different way, he told Putin. I didn't know it was going to turn out this way. Yeltsin claimed, improbably, that he would get back into construction or move back to Sverdlovsk, where he had begun his career. He looked out the window at the gray, snowy landscape, lost in thought. After an interlude, he returned to the matter at hand. You haven't answered me, he said to Putin, looking him in the eye. Putin, at last, agreed. No one else knew of their conversation, according to Yeltsin, or the momentous decision they had made. When the votes were counted on the night of December 19th, after an election that was fiercely contested and considered more or less fair, unity had achieved a stunning upset. The Communist Party had won a plurality of 24%, consolidating its base, but unity came in second with 23%. The Lushkov-Primakov alliance, which had seemed poised to coast to power only months before, lagged behind with only 13% of the vote, its leaders battered by negative television coverage and badly beaten. Yabloko and a new liberal coalition that allied with Yeltsin, the Union of Right Forces, which Putin had also endorsed with a few polite words, together won nearly as much. Yeltsin drank champagne on election night in anticipation of a victory, but went to bed worrying as the unofficial results trickled in. When he woke, he felt his trust in Putin had been vindicated. Yeltsin boasted that he had maneuvered Putin from obscurity into the presidency over fierce resistance from the political elite, inside and outside the Kremlin. It really was very hard getting Putin into the job, one of the hardest things we ever pulled off, Yeltsin's daughter Tatiana later said. For Yeltsin, this would be his parting legacy, one that would reshape the country he had nurtured out of the ruins of the Soviet Union. For the first time in his turbulent presidency, Yeltsin could rely on a pro-government majority in the new Duma, ending the paralyzing political clashes over Russia's transition. He could have cemented his policies and even introduced new ones in his remaining 6 months as president. Instead, he resigned. On December 28th, Yeltsin sat in front of a decorated tree in the Kremlin's reception hall and taped the president's traditional New Year's address. When he finished, he complained that his voice was hoarse and he did not like the remarks. He asked the television crew to come back in 3 days and, despite their protests, record a new address. It was a ruse, though apparently only he knew it then. He returned to his residence and that evening summoned his current and former chiefs of staff, two of his closest advisors. What he said stunned them. He planned to resign on New Year's Eve. Yeltsin had one last grandiose, impetuous surprise to unleash on the country. He would end his presidency with the old millennium and let Vladimir Putin usher in the new one. The next morning, he called Putin to the Kremlin and told him the timing of what they had discussed in the abstract 15 days before. I immediately had the impression that he was a different man, Yeltsin thought when the prime minister arrived. The discussion that followed was practical, detailed, and unemotional. They discussed the decrees that Yeltsin and then Putin would issue, the re-recording of the New Year's address, the notification of the military and security agencies, the transfer of the suitcase carrying the codes to launch Russia's arsenal of nuclear weapons. When they finished, they emerged from Yeltsin's office, constrained by the public setting. They said nothing, though Yeltsin felt the urge to say more. Instead, they shook hands. Then Yeltsin wrapped Putin in a bear hug and said goodbye. Their next meeting was on New Year's Eve. On December 30th, Putin filled in for Yeltsin at a reception in the Kremlin. The aging president's absence was noted, but given his frequent bouts of ill health, assigned little significance. Despite the festive occasion, Putin focused his remarks on the war in Chechnya, which was turning into a gruesome bloodbath as Russian forces surrounded Grozny. The city was reduced to ruins, the likes of which had not been seen in Russia or anywhere else since the Great Patriotic War. Thousands of civilians remained trapped inside, cowering in basements with no electricity, heat, or running water. Chechnya's rebels continued to hold much of Grozny, killing hundreds of the Russian soldiers trying to seize it. Aslan Maskharov reiterated his calls for a negotiated ceasefire, even as he vowed to keep fighting. Even if the war lasts 10 years, Russia will not manage to subjugate Chechnya and its people, he declared. As the fighting worsened, Russia faced mounting criticism from Europe and the United States about the unfolding humanitarian crisis, including evidence that Russian soldiers were conducting summary executions in cleansing operations in liberated areas. Soldiers in Russian-controlled areas of Chechnya apparently have carte blanche to loot and pillage. Many people have returned briefly to their homes to find them stripped bare of household goods and other valuables, Human Rights Watch wrote in a letter to the United Nations Security Council, calling for an international investigation into war crimes. At the Kremlin, Putin brushed aside misgivings about the brutality of the war, saying it was the country's duty to crush the brazen and impudent rebels at all costs. Unfortunately, he told the assembled guests before lifting a toast to the new year, not everyone in Western nations understood this, but we will not tolerate any humiliation to the national pride of Russians or any threat to the integrity of the country. Yeltsin woke early the next morning, and before he left for the Kremlin, he at last told his wife, Nina, of his decision to resign. How wonderful, she exclaimed. Finally! Still, only 6 people knew as he rode to the Kremlin for the last time as president, not even his presidential guard or his aides, who left his mail, his schedule, and his other documents on his desk. Voloshin, his chief of staff, arrived with a decree stating that the resignation would take effect at midnight. Yeltsin summoned Putin, who arrived on time at 9:30, and then read the decree aloud. He looked at Putin, who gave a slightly embarrassed smile, and then shook Yeltsin's hand. Now, Yeltsin taped a new address, and Yumashev accompanied the recording in an armored car to the Ostankino television tower with orders to broadcast it at noon. As the new millennium began in the Pacific and marched hour by hour across each time zone, Yeltsin addressed, "My dear friends," one last time. I have heard people say more than once that Yeltsin would cling to power as long as possible, that he would never let go, he said. That is a lie. He said that he wanted to create a vital precedent of voluntary transfer of power to a newly elected president, but that he would not wait until the presidential election scheduled for June. Russia should enter the new millennium with new politicians, new faces, new people who are intelligent, strong, and energetic, while we, those who have been in power for many years, must leave. Yeltsin rubbed a speck from his eye and finished with a strikingly personal appeal to the country he had led for 8 years. I want to ask your forgiveness for the dreams that have not come true, and for the things that seemed easy but turned out to be so excruciatingly difficult. I am asking your forgiveness for failing to justify the hopes of those who believed me when I said that we would leap from the gray, stagnating, totalitarian past into a bright, prosperous, and civilized future. I believed in that dream. I believed that we would cover that distance in one leap. We didn't. Lyudmila had not watched Yeltsin's address, but 5 minutes after it ended, a friend telephoned. Lyuda, I congratulate you, she said. And I you, Lyudmila replied, thinking they were exchanging best wishes for the new year. Her friend had to explain that her husband had become the acting president of the country. Putin had not divulged Yeltsin's secret after their first meeting on December 14th, or the timing after the second on December 29th. She heard it along with the rest of Russia. Her husband's rise in Moscow had left her marveling at times that she was married to a man who yesterday was really just an unknown deputy mayor of Petersburg. As she had feared when he returned to the FSB, her family's life became constrained. The girls, now 15 and 13, had to stop going to the German school they had been attending since they arrived in Moscow. They were tutored at home. Security guards accompanied them on their rare excursions to the theater or cinema. When asked, Lyudmila said she had only three close friends. When Putin returned to the FSB, she had had to end a friendship she had developed with the wife of a German banker, Irina Peach, while they were in Petersburg. "She was not happy at all," said Peach, who went on to write Delicate Friendships, a titillating book about the Putins that described a stormy marriage. In it, Lyudmila complained that her husband would not let her use a credit card, no doubt worried about the scandals surrounding Yeltsin's daughters, and joked that his lifestyle was like a vampire's. "This isolation is dreadful," Lyudmila told Peach when she ended the friendship. "No more traveling wherever we want to go, no longer able to say what we want. I had only just begun to live." Her husband, too, could be cutting and dismissive of her opinions. He once told Peach during a week-long visit to their dacha in Arkhangelskaya that anyone who could spend 3 weeks with Lyudmila deserved a monument. Now, Lyudmila was about to become First Lady, a modern Western role that Russians viewed ambivalently. She cried when she learned of her husband's new job, she said, because she realized that our private life was over for at least 3 months until the presidential elections, or perhaps for 4 years. Putin, after Yeltsin's announcement, presided over a meeting of the Security Council, which he had led until becoming prime minister only 4 months before. Its members included the leaders of the Duma and the Federation Council, as well as the ministers of defense and the interior and the intelligence chiefs. Those in the room had been in Moscow far longer than he had, and had far more experience in government and politics. Now they listened as he outlined his priorities. He pledged no change in Russia's foreign policy, but signaled a new era in military affairs. Russia had to improve its weaponry and address the social problems of its conscripted ranks, an aspect that has been neglected recently. He noted the conspicuous absence of the prosecutor general, Yuri Skuratov, whose investigations had done as much as anything to propel him to his post, but then pointedly added that the acting prosecutor, Vladimir Ustinov, seemed to be doing a good job. His remarks were brief, almost perfunctory given the occasion. He urged vigilance for the new year, given the fear of potential Y2K computer glitches that around the world had been the biggest news of the day until Yeltsin's resignation. Putin then recorded his own New Year's address, the one that Yeltsin would normally have delivered, to be broadcast at midnight in Moscow. He began with his own embellishment, saying that he and his family had planned to gather around the television that night and listen to Yeltsin's speech, but things took a different turn. He assured listeners that there would be no power vacuum, not for a minute, and vowed to continue his efforts to restore law and order. "I promise you that any attempts to act contrary to the Russian law and constitution will be cut short," he ended by offering his gratitude to the nation's first president. "We will be able to see the true importance of what Boris Yeltsin has done for Russia," he said, "only after some time has passed." As Yeltsin prepared to leave the Kremlin, he paused in the hallway outside his office, now Putin's, and extracted from his pocket the pen he had used to sign his last decree. He gave it to Putin as they walked out to the door of the Kremlin, two men so different in temperament and physique. Their relationship, Putin said later, had not been particularly close. It was never warm in the way that he remembered his feelings for Sobchak. I can say that only when he began to discuss the question of his resignation with me did I sense a certain warmth in him, Putin recalled later. Now Yeltsin wanted to say something important about the burden he would now face. Take care, he told him. Take care of Russia. A soft, gentle snowfall surrounded the Kremlin's grounds as he twisted his large, frail frame into the armored car that would take him home. Bill Clinton telephoned on the drive back to his dacha, but Yeltsin had an aide tell him to call back later. He went home and took a nap. That evening, Putin signed his first decree. It was 7 pages long, having been prepared by Yeltsin's aides in the previous 2 days, though Yeltsin would claim he was not aware of it until it was completed. It granted Yeltsin an array of benefits and privileges as a former president, including a salary, a staff, and the use of the dacha where he had spent so much of his second term convalescing. It also made Yeltsin immune from prosecution, protecting his assets and papers from search or seizure. With a sweep of the pen Yeltsin passed to him, Putin ended the threat that Skuratov had exposed and that very nearly brought Yeltsin to ruin. Putin then carried out his own New Year's surprise. He and his successor at the FSB, Nikolai Patrushev, along with their wives and a popular singer, secretly flew to Dagestan. The Putins told the girls that they would be gone that night, but not where they were going. They had already given the girls their presents, their first computers, and left them in Moscow with Ludmila's sister and one of Masha's friends. After arriving in Dagestan, Putin and the others boarded 3 military helicopters and flew toward Chechnya's second-largest city, Gudermes, recently liberated from the Chechen rebels. The weather was so foul, with visibility so limited, that the helicopters had to turn back. When the new year and the new millennium arrived, they were still airborne, but they opened 2 bottles of champagne and passed them around, drinking from the bottles since they had no glasses. When they landed in Dagestan's capital, Mahachkala, they climbed into military vehicles under heavy escort and drove 2.5 hours back into Chechnya. It was nearly dawn when Putin greeted the Russian troops there. They looked tired and a little disoriented, as though they wanted to pinch themselves, Lyudmila recalled. Were they dreaming? It had been a quiet night in Gudermes, but only 23 miles away, Grozny endured one of the heaviest nights of bombing to date. Putin, dressed in a turtleneck, again handed out medals and ceremonial knives. I want you to know that Russia highly appreciates what you're doing, Putin told the soldiers mustered there. This is not just about restoring Russia's honor and dignity. It's about putting an end to the breakup of the Russian Federation. The Yeltsin era was over. The Putin era had begun.